Morrissey with contributing producer Robert Knight, associate producer Leslie Kane. Technical directors Mary Bishop, Rinta Giesler. We had help from Stephanie Hendricks, Eric Park. Check us out on the web, www.flashpoints.net. Thanks to John Lionheart, our web maestro, and thanks for listening.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. Coming up next, Queer Voices.
Hello and welcome to the Monday edition of the KPFT Sports Brief. In ice hockey news, the Houston Aeros clinched a spot in the American Hockey League playoffs by defeating the San Antonio Rampage 4-1 on Sunday at home in the Compaq Center in Houston. In rugby union news, the Woodlands Rugby Football Club defeated Dallas 14-0 on Saturday in a forfeited match because Dallas did not have enough players. In international rugby union news, England defeated Italy 40-5 in Six Nations action on Sunday. As the Bush administration prepares for war with Iraq, footballers go on with life in Iraq and the constant threat of war. The Al Talaba club team of Iraq lost 1-0 to Peruzzi of Iran in a cold drizzle on Sunday as part of the Asian Football Confederation's Champions League. The tournament also includes teams from Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan. The Iraqis are scheduled to play two more games before the tournament ends on Thursday, 4 days before the proposal by the United States and Britain setting a March 17th deadline for Iraq to disarm. Iraqi players brushed aside questions about whether they're teams will have a homeland after the match or their rivalry, Iran. And this has been Richard Hanna with the Monday edition of the KPFT Sports Brief.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening. This is Jack Walensky.
And I'm Joan Devlin.
And J.D. Doyle.
And Glenn Holt.
We have a lot on our show tonight.
That's right. A lot.
A lot is going on. This week has happened or going on, coming up. The march on... Actually, it's not going to be a march this year. It's going to be a rally at the Capitol. You know, right. We're getting a little bit too old to march.
That's right. We're just rallying.
Gathering.
At the Capitol on Sunday, Lesbian Gay Rights Lobby. In fact, Randall Ellis should have been on the line right now, but he'll probably be calling in a minute or so. And then we have Beverly McPhill, who wrote this wonderful op-ed piece in the Chronicle in January about Bush already declaring war on women. And I'm sure if we expand it a bit, we can also talk about being, you know, declaring war on anybody who's progressive. Then we have some information coming from Montrose Clinic.
That's right. They're going to be having a health awareness week, and that will be starting, I want to say, a week from today. And Sana Alton is going to be on to talk to us about that and exactly what that's going to be to entail.
And in the second hour, we're going to be talking to somebody who was one of the earliest DJs at Kindred Spirits.
Wow.
Because coming up this week is a Kindred Spirits reunion. And that's going to be happening on Saturday the 15th between 8 p.m. and 1 a.m. And it is a fundraiser. And it's a fundraiser for the Montrose Clinic / Counseling Center, Houston's Buyers Club, and Lesbian Health Initiative. And this is the second one they've had. And I thought it'd be interesting to talk about the history of Marion Coleman's Kindred Spirits, because it was really a bar that was, you know, incredibly well run. And
very, very welcoming.
Yes, yes. And it still hasn't been replaced in the community for what it stood for.
Well, there's a tire store there now.
Yeah. It's just amazing. Actually, I'd love to do a book on what used to be convenience stores and what they are now. But I'm getting off the subject. And then also, Paul Guillory would be here to talk about...
The most recent meeting of the men's gathering. I think it's called something like, Is That God or Ethel Merman? So that should be kind of interesting.
So all that's coming up and more, but let's first listen to News Wrap from This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending March 8th, 2003. Australia's National Senate this week approved a resolution calling for equal benefits for the same-gender partners of gay and lesbian service members. The resolution was introduced by openly gay Australian Democratic Party Senator from West Australia, Brian Gregg, who said that while it didn't change the law, it put pressure on the government to do so. His party was joined in supporting it by the Australian Labor Party, although the ruling coalition opposed it. The resolution is part of a continuing national campaign for equal military partner benefits, including a number of actions as the nation celebrated Australia Day in January. The Australian Defence Force formally lifted its ban on military service by gays and lesbians more than a decade ago. But although gay and lesbian service members can list their partners as next of kin, those partners still do not qualify for spousal benefits, including housing benefits, relocation expenses, grief counseling, death benefits compensation, or survivor's pensions.
Sweden's government this week announced plans to register its citizens' gay and lesbian partnerships at its embassies that perform heterosexual marriages. Foreign Minister Anna Lindh told Sweden's parliament, "It is very important for Sweden for civil servants who officiate at weddings to be authorized also to officiate at the registration of partnerships. Once we have established that a country accepts partnership registration, we will begin to authorize our civil servants at those embassies." 21 Swedish embassies now perform marriages, and arrangements will first be made with 8 of the nations that host them, likely including France, Portugal, and Israel.
But hopes for civil marriages are fading in Israel, where currently only Orthodox Jewish rabbis can marry even heterosexual couples. The Shinui Party has broken its campaign promises by dropping its support for the Labor Party's civil marriage bill, apparently as part of negotiations in forming a governing coalition with the conservative establishment. Gay and lesbian couples led a protest demonstration outside the Knesset last week, releasing hundreds of balloons to symbolize Shinui's airy promises blowing away.
And a bill to reserve legal marriage exclusively for heterosexual couples has been introduced in the Parliament of American Samoa. It's sponsored by Representative Suak Carl Schuster.
Scotland, too, is gearing up for a struggle over legal recognition of unmarried couples, including gay and lesbian couples. At their party convention this week, the opposition Liberal Democrats overwhelmingly adopted registered partnerships as a plank in their campaign platform for Scottish Parliament elections in May. Partnered gay delegate Richard Coxon waved his supermarket membership card as he told the convention, "The state does not give me anything to prove we are a partnership, but Tesco does. This is a joint card. If I want to prove we are in a settled relationship, I have to get Tesco to do it. This is lunacy." The Christian group Evangelical Alliance immediately vowed to mount a major campaign against what it called a false image of marriage to make it a key issue in the elections. The proposed registry would carry legal status equal to marriage in areas including employment, pensions, property, taxation, immigration, inheritance, adoption, and fostering.
Denmark's government has green-lighted fostering by gays and lesbians, but rejected a move to allow them to adopt children from other countries. Those are the positions of the Minister for Social Affairs, as reported by the Copenhagen Post. The head of Denmark's National Gay and Lesbian Group, LBL, Peter Andersen, responded that, "It seems rather odd that the minister feels homosexuals can be trusted with other people's children, but are not good enough to look after their own." Although Denmark became the first nation in the world to legally recognize same-gender couples well over a decade ago, LBL says it now lags far behind other European Union member nations.
As South Africa's Constitutional Court heard arguments last week in the unusual case of a lesbian couple who are both biological parents of their twins, the judges criticized the government more generally for dragging its feet on legal recognition of same-gender couples. In the case before the court, the women known as J and B used sperm from an anonymous donor for in vitro fertilization of an egg one donated and the other carried term. The Durban High Court in November affirmed that they should both be named as mothers on the twins' birth certificates and declared unconstitutional the current law preventing that. South Africa's constitution was the first in the world to explicitly protect gays and lesbians from discrimination. Last month, the government decided to drop its opposition to the women's claim, but last week, government attorneys formally asked the Constitutional Court for a year's delay in implementing the legal change to allow the parliament to make the amendment. Judge Lori Ackerman scoffed at the request, noting the government has failed to take action on the legal status of same-gender couples despite a series of legal judgments beginning in 1999. Other constitutional court judges supported Ackerman's contention that the issue urgently needs the government's attention. The court itself reserved judgment on both the Durbin ruling and the government request for a stay.
U.S. courts and legislatures were also busy with gay and lesbian family issues this week. A federal appeals court heard a legal challenge to Florida's ban on adoptions by gays and lesbians, while Massachusetts' highest state court heard a lawsuit seeking to open legal marriage to same-gender couples. Neither ruling is expected for several months. In Florida, a group is petitioning legislators to repeal the ban before the court issues its decision, while in Massachusetts, Democratic Speaker of the House Thomas Finneran promised an amendment to the state constitution to prohibit gay and lesbian marriages should the court find in their favor.
In Texas, where same-gender marriages and their recognition are explicitly banned, a trial court judge granted a divorce decree to a gay male couple who'd contracted a Vermont civil union. Those unions are generally not recognized by other states, and last year a Connecticut appeals court rejected one man's bid to dissolve his.
Also in Texas, Houston's Klein Independent School District agreed to formation of a gay-straight alliance at Klein High School, settling a federal lawsuit brought by student Marla Dukler with the help of the American Civil Liberties Union. While the agreement preserves the district's policy requiring written parental consent for participation, Dukler said that all 16 students wishing to join the club had obtained it.
In California, a state appeals court reversed a trial court's dismissal to reinstate a San Diego lesbians discrimination lawsuit. Guadalupe Benitez was denied artificial insemination services by doctors at the North Coast Women's Care Medical Group, she claims because of their religious objections. Benitez had to go elsewhere and pay for the service, which her health plan would have covered at that clinic. Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund, which is representing Benitez, said the ruling is the first of its kind in the U.S. to say that health care providers cannot discriminate against patients based on sexual orientation.
The California state agency overseeing adoptions and foster care has ordered a Santa Ana-based private agency to stop discriminating against gays and lesbians. The state's Community Care Licensing Division ordered Olive Crest Foster Family and Adoption Agency to develop a non-discriminatory recruitment policy. In doing so, the state upheld a claim by lesbian couple Dr. Shannon Rose and Jane Brooks that Olive Crest had deliberately stalled in processing their application to adopt. Rose and Brooks may also take their case to court.
Last week, a federal jury in Maryland rejected a San Francisco man's claim of discrimination against the Maryland Shock Trauma Center for denying him visitation with his now-deceased registered partner. Bill Flanagan had a power of attorney for health care for his late partner, Robert Daniel, but was unable to obtain any information about his status from the center for 4 hours until Daniel's mother and sister arrived. Lambda Legal Defense is likely to appeal on his behalf.
An Iowa bill to explicitly prohibit gay and lesbian couples from adopting or fostering children has died for this legislative session. Although a state Senate committee had considered the much-protested bill last month, it took no vote, and now Republican Senate Majority Leader Stuart Iverson has told reporters that it will neither advance to the floor nor be reintroduced.
Also dead for the year is the Gay Inclusive Hate Crimes Bill that surprisingly passed the Utah State House last week, only to be immediately voted to be reconsidered. This week, its sponsor, Democratic Representative from Salt Lake City David Litvak, chose to let it die quietly rather than see it be defeated after what he feared would be a divisive and ugly debate. Litvak promised to reintroduce the measure next year, although 2004 elections may make passage still more difficult.
But the Hawaii State Senate this week approved a bill to add gender identity and expression as a category protected under that state's hate crime law. All 20 Democrats supported the measure, joined by only 2 Republican senators. The bill moves next to the Hawaii House.
And finally, cricket's World Cup tournament included Zimbabwe, despite some protests against human rights violations by its notoriously homophobic president, Robert Mugabe. The event opened last month in Cape Town with a globally televised ceremony in which each of the 14 teams was led onto the field by a model. It emerged only last week that the beautiful Barbara Diop, who marched at the head of Zimbabwe's own team, is a trans woman.
And that's News Wrap for the week ending March 8th, 2003, written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
I'm Greg Gordon.
This is Queer Voices.
Well, it's that time of the every other year when we all get together to rally in front of the Capitol. And Randall Ellis is with us from, he's the executive director of Lesbian Gay Rights Lobby in Austin. Are you all prepared?
We're making our final preparations. We're excited about this weekend. It's a huge weekend here in Austin. HRC has their black tie dinner on Saturday. We have a rally on Sunday, and we've had an overwhelming response to it this year. And then on Monday, we have our annual lobby day where we fan out and cover the whole entire Capitol in one day with people that have come into lobby on these issues that we're facing this session.
But all your events are free.
All our events are free, absolutely free, yes.
Well, the fact is that we don't have a single elected official statewide in Texas that is not a Republican.
Right.
That both houses, am I correct? Is it both houses are controlled by the Republicans?
Both are controlled by the Republicans. The
executive branch is controlled by the Republicans. The judicial branch is controlled by the Republicans. Do we have a chance?
Well, as you know, LGRL represents the GLE community, and we're a nonpartisan
right.
group.
Right.
And we do have a chance. We have made a lot of headway on issues that we thought would be a tough battle this year. I mean, it's still a tough battle, but for example, the foster care and adoption bill, although we continue to see anti-gay bills filed, such as one that was filed last week by Representative Tolson, another one, the message is ringing true with legislators in that, one, they realize that child welfare is at stake, these family issues, and, you know, there are a limited number of families out there, and to ban gays and lesbians from serving as foster parents or adoptive parents, only small makes that pool smaller, and that's not something we can afford to do, nor should we place that extra burden in our child welfare system.
Well, and the state is also facing a $10 billion deficit.
Exactly. And, you know, and I've said this, you know, and sometimes people look at me kind of strangely. I said, you know, the deficit is the biggest thing we have going for the LGBT movement this session. And that
really?
It really, you know, there are many places where it hurts us. You know, with the HIV and AIDS ADAP program, that's a place that we've seen some crunches, but we're able to, you know, push back the decision that TDH wanted to make that. But in terms of the foster care and adoption issue, I mean, there's a $16 million price tag attached to those two bills.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's no way that a bill with a fiscal note like that should be coming out of a committee. I mean, last session when they had a surplus, there was a gentleman's agreement that bill with fiscal notes attached to them would not come out of committee. New leadership this year, not the same agreement among legislators, but it would make it very hard to push forth the agenda of intolerance.
Yeah, that is pretty interesting. The events that are going on, there's a rally on Sunday.
In front of the Capitol.
Okay, and it starts at 12:30 and goes on till 2. And what are the predictions of weather so far?
Well, you know, funny, we've been watching that closely. Right now, it's forecasted to be about mid-70s. A slight chance of showers at this point, according to weather.com. But as you know, to predict out that far is a little difficult. We're hoping for a great Texas spring weather.
Well, it could very well be that.
That's what we're hoping for, and we're saying all of our prayers to the appropriate people, and you know, keeping our fingers crossed. But that takes place at 12:30 on the south steps. That's the front of the Capitol. Afterwards, we're going to move on down to the Alamo Draft House here in Austin downtown. Screening of a few films. After that, we're having a social mixer at the 1920s Club, which is right on South Congress, or on Congress, actually up by the Capitol. So it's a weekend full of events.
I wanted to ask you, how many participants do you think you're going to have, especially from places a little bit far-reaching from Austin? And also, for those who may never have done this before, you know, is it kind of scary, or is it actually pretty simple to go in and just talk to your legislators?
On the lobby day, you know, that's the one thing that we hear from people when I'm talking to them. I've been doing a lot of talking on the phone, like, I don't know how to lobby, you know, how do I do it? You know, we start the day off with a training session that we continue throughout the day on how to go in and approach a legislative staff and approach a legislator and let them know what the issues of concern that you're talking about are. It's really not a scary process. I understand the intimidation, having been a new staff person one time up at the Capitol, but they're all human beings and don't have any special powers that they can ban you or trace you or anything like that. The response has been overwhelming. I know in Houston alone, they're talking about bringing up two buses, one to stay overnight so that the people that are interested in staying to lobby on the 17th can actually do that. And, you know, typically we do get a lot of people in from smaller towns, and we're talking about towns like Lubbock and Amarillo that don't necessarily have gay pride events, and so they look at this weekend's events as their time to get out and shine and to be amongst the brothers and sisters.
Right, and that's especially important. You know, I'm in a safe district myself. But the other side of Montrose isn't necessarily safe. It's not a safe district anymore. But I guess it's really important for people who've come from smaller towns, who still have family from smaller towns, or who are listening from smaller towns.
Exactly. It's important for them to be there on Sunday and be there on Monday to get to know the process and you know show that our strength is in our numbers. But you know, there's also an ongoing project that we started at LGRO, which is the District Lobbying Project, where our goal is to make sure that as every legislative district in the district office gets a visit from a GLBT person, that we're out there showing them that, you know, everyone thinks that their county is the county that has no gays or lesbians living in them. I think there were only 99% of the counties in the United States had gay and lesbian households in them. So.
Right, and that's just what the census says. We know that there's probably 100%.
But, you know, we have this new project that we've kicked off this year that makes it real easy. Once again, we provide you with all the materials on how to lobby, how to talk, and the talking points on various issues to go into an office and how to schedule appointments, the whole nine yards. So it's very important that legislators realize that there are many of us out there and that these bills that they filed affect many people.
Okay, so the best place to get information from would probably be the website, correct?
Our website at www.lgrl.org.
Right, and I'm not sure who's organizing the buses from Houston.
That is the community center.
Okay.
Has organized that. And hold on a second. I don't have that email in front of me, but I saw a glimpse of it today. I can actually give you the information on that as well.
The community center is located at 3400 Montrose on the second floor.
Yeah, exactly. Let's see, and I don't have it here with me. I'm sorry about that.
Well, and we'll find it and give it to our listeners before the end of the show.
That'd be great.
I'm sure you're really extremely busy between working in the legislature and getting this all set up between you and your staff. And I'm sure it's going to be a great event, and I would really encourage all of our listeners, if they have the opportunity, to go to Austin for the rally and for Lobby Day, because it's not only something that we need to do, but it's a great educational event.
Great,
Randall. Randall Ellis is Executive Director of Lesbian Gay Rights Lobby in Austin, and for more information for this weekend's event, you can go to lgrl.org. You're listening to Queer Voices.
This is Queer Voices.
Bad stuff coming down with them.
Right. I have a few notes.
In January, there was an op-ed piece from in the Chronicle. Believe it or not, in the Chronicle. Every once in a while, we get some good stuff there. And the title was, Bush Has Already Declared War on Women. And I started reading this, and not only was it a great piece, but it was also authored by a person here who lives in Houston and was able to get into the Chronicle. And with us this evening is
Beverly McPhail.
Beverly, tell us a little bit about the article you wrote.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm really glad to be here today. I was really writing about something that really concerned me, is that I think the public at large gets a really false view of President Bush, that he's some type of women's advocate, because he seems to surround himself with these powerful women and has two daughters. And so I think it's really easy to think, wow, he must be really supportive of women and women's issues. But when you're in the know and on listservs and follow the women's issues, he is clearly, and him and his administration are just putting policy after policy that are undercutting the rights of women. And I think it's going unnoticed with everything else going on in the world today.
Well, and some of us who listen to NPR or listen to Democracy Now!
Or listen to KPFT.
In general, right. You know, we can find out, we hear these things, and it's so scary to me. You know, it looks like everything that we fought for the past 40 years is just being behind the scenes.
Thrown under the bus, crushed.
Can you give us some examples?
Well, a good example, I think, is Title IX. That was a part of the educational amendments of 1972, and it ensured equality, educational equality for women in federally funded institutions. And like you said, we thought that battle had been fought. Just to give you a couple numbers, before Title IX, only 1 in 27 girls played varsity high school sports. Today, that figure is 1 in 2.5. I mean, so we've made these wonderful advances. So, you know, I would think, well, if it ain't broke, why fix it? Well,
right, because doesn't that offer scholarships and other opportunities for women that had not been offered in the past?
Exactly. It's not just about sports, right? It's some people's foothold into college. For instance, back in the day, women's athletic scholarships were non-existent. In 1997, there were over 10,000. So it is one way women get entree into college. But Bush's administration put together, and I love his sort of Orwellian speak, the commission is called Commission on Opportunity in Athletics. And it was really started as a way to undermine Title IX. And it was really skillful. I guess you have to admire them a little bit, how skillfully they do this.
Right, and I used to think he was stupid, but apparently he's not. Either he's not, or his people are not.
Right, and they orchestrated this whole movement where they put on this dog and pony show, and this commission went from city to city, state to state, and really overloaded it was supposedly fact-finding mission, but overloaded it with people who were against Title IX. And they came up with recommendations to weaken Title IX. And Title IX, I mean, acting like it's such a big, scary thing. However, the threat of it, the penalty for not following Title IX, is a loss of federal funding. But that's never happened at any school.
Well, that's because they're following it. I mean, you know, I would say that it's been very rare, especially recently, that you've gotten these schools that are not following the rules, the Title IX rules. So again, like you said, if it's not broke, don't fix it.
Right. I think one of the problems that the opponents felt like is that a lot of the smaller men's sports, especially men's wrestling, men's gymnastics, their programs were getting dismantled, and they were blaming women's sports on that, because part of the Title IX is a proportionality test, meaning that you have to have proportionate number of women athletes to your women undergraduate students and male athletes to male students. It is interesting now, women are outnumbering men at colleges at the undergraduate level. And so they're really hurting, because now they need to up the number of female athletes. Well, instead of upping the number of female athletes, they're trying to decrease it. And some of the programs were cutting men's wrestling. But I think what the real problem is not pitting men's sports against women's sports, but is pitting all sports against football. I mean, football is a sacred cow.
Right.
And so football just eats up coaches, salaries, eats up
scholarships
and everything. And so instead of going after that, I guess women's sports are an easier pick. So that's where they're going after.
And there really isn't women's football per se. I mean, that's one. You know, we have women's basketball, women's baseball, on and on. But really, you know, football is, there's maybe a toehold. But for the most part, we're not seeing, you know, any kind of real effort for, you know, women's football.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one thing that's surprising to me, I heard a woman who's really quite knowledgeable about Title IX. I'm blanking on her name at the moment, but she said something that I did remember, in spite of not knowing her name, which was that Title IX made some fathers feminist. That was an unintended consequence, because you know how sports gung ho our culture is. Well, some dads, they wouldn't call themselves a feminist, but when their daughter was playing softball and they didn't have a good field, or they couldn't get equipment, or they didn't have a bus to take them to games, they became feminists. They were really advocates advocating for their daughters. And it's surprising to me to hear Bush has 20 daughters, and I hear they play softball up in Austin, that he wouldn't support, you know, the full rights for women. And it's not only Title IX. Title IX is one area. You know, in welfare, increasing the requirements on women to work more, that education doesn't count as part of that work. Decreasing funding in some areas, but increasing it for absences-only programs and $300 million for marriage promotion activities.
Well, but it's, you know, it's one thing to say, okay, you've got to work and help pull your weight. But the other thing is then there's no daycare. Or if there is, they don't match the hours because frequently women get the jobs on second or third shift or the lowest paying jobs. And now that jobs are being cut back, they're the first ones to go.
You're exactly right. And minimum wage jobs, we know, don't support families. I love Barbara Ehrenreich's new book, Nickeled and Dimed.
Yes, I read about that.
Joan did a review in the Texas Triangle on that book.
Right. She did a wonderful job of showing that you can't do it. You can't, and she did it even without
With no children.
And having a car.
Working 60 hours a week. Yeah, and having a car. Yeah, so that she could actually drive to places.
Right.
Well, not only that, but live in places that were less expensive because they were further out from the center of town.
Right.
I think maybe a common denominator here talking about, you know, with Title IX and welfare and these other things is that Bush policy seems to operate on stereotypes about women. And the stereotype there on welfare, I think it was Ronald Reagan that coined it, you know, the welfare queen, you know, that these are women who are, you know, driving to the welfare office, have 20
in
kids,
a Cadillac,
in a Cadillac.
Right. Yeah,
and that's really not the case. And so it's terrible that they make policy based on these stereotypes.
Well, but you can even take it a step back further. They don't have choices. Dealing with the chance of birth control being available, because that's all being changed, not only here in this country, but the Bush administration is taking that choice or that option away of even being taught in other countries.
They don't have the choice of terminating a pregnancy because they can't afford a child or don't feel that it's the right, you know, and they're in the middle of schooling or there's a reason why for this, whatever the reason, this is not a good time in their life for them to bear a child. Mm-hmm. And he's working to, you know, change laws around that.
Oh, I think definitely. And that's one of the paradoxes I think that I brought up in the editorial was, how could he surround himself with people like Condoleezza Rice and Karen Hughes, you know, women that he obviously admires, who are, you know, advising him on policy, both foreign and domestic, and he trusts their opinion and trusts their judgment. However, you know, if they had an unplanned pregnancy, he wouldn't trust them to make the best decision about their life. You know, to me, that is such a contradiction. And he talks about women as a group. I think he likes maybe entrust individual women, but doesn't trust women as a group to do what's best for them. And that's, to me, what choice is all about. I mean, another paradox, too, is, you know, of course, we know he's very hand-off regulating business. You know, don't touch business, laissez-faire. But then regulating women's lives, I mean, I can't imagine that if men had to go through the same thing that women do before they had a procedure, you know, had to come in for all these requirements, you know, they don't...
24-hour waiting period.
Exactly. And more they're saying they need this forced education. I read an alarming article, I think it was even in the Chronicle, where now some of these pregnancy, I'm doing quotations here, crisis pregnancy centers, who women call because they're in a crisis pregnancy, but they really are sort of propaganda machines to try to get women to... not have an abortion. They're buying ultrasound machines and showing women, you know, what their fetus looks like, again, in an attempt to stop them from having an abortion. But I just trust women. You know, I trust women to make the best choices for themselves. I mean, I don't want to make that choice for another woman, but I definitely want to make it for myself. But how the government, you know, wants to get into our business and into our bedrooms.
Well, think about it. You know, in Indiana and rural areas in the Midwest, there's what they call a 24-hour waiting period. And these women, often from the country, have to drive many miles, a long period of time, to get to this place, to sit through a class, drive home, you know, possibly take a day off work to get out there, wait 24 hours, drive back the next day, and then have the procedure. And 2 days worth of work, 2 days of finding a car, 2 days of 4 to 6 hours of driving back and forth to the only place in town that'll perform the procedure. Many of them can't do it. And it's almost like emotional blackmail in a way, because what they're doing is, if we can't if you won't listen to our reasons why you can't have it, we'll just keep making it so hard on you and so inconvenient for you that no matter what you do, you're going to be forced to have this child.
Oh, I think you're exactly right. I mean, so far Roe v. Wade is holding, and so they're just chipping away at all sorts of other little pieces. I'm amazed at some of the other things they do. Let me see if I have my little handy-dandy notes here. They, of course, the partial birth with the so-called partial birth abortion, you know,
which
they have
extremely rare that procedure has ever been used.
Exactly. And the laws right now, the one they're proposing, is so vague that there's a fear that it could cover any abortion, because the word partial birth abortion is not a medical term. So when these legislators, who are not doctors for the most part, are writing this legislation that affects medical people in language that isn't medical, it's very much open to interpretation. Limiting stem cell research. I mean, this is another one where they're so worried about the position of the fetus that important vital research isn't getting done. Another one is the Unborn Victims of Violence Act. I don't know if you've heard about that one, but it creates a separate offense if a defendant causes the death of an unborn child during a commission of a federal crime. Well, you know, in some ways that sounds...
You can't get hate crimes laws passed for gay people.
Right.
Go figure that one out.
Living, breathing people don't count, but the fetus rights gets elevated. And I think all of these are attempts, again, to whittle away at women's right to choose.
Well, the other thing is, and we were talking about this, is... And you say fetus, and that's the correct term, because once this child is born, this fetus, you know, becomes a living, breathing person, they don't care anymore. You know, once the woman gone through and carried the pregnancy to term, oh well, too bad if you starve, too bad if you can't find a job, too bad if you can't support this child, too bad if this child does not have adequate medical care. It's all just about basically making sure the woman bears the child. Once the child has been born, they couldn't care less.
I think you're right. And to me, that points out something very important. Like, what do they really care about? If it's not really the fetus and that child when it's born and their quality of life later, then what is all the emphasis on it? And I think more it's about controlling women, you know, controlling women. And I guess we could, you know, get Freudian, like, where does that come from, this, you know, male fear maybe of women and women's power? You know, we talk about penis envy, but, you know, I think there's a lot of maybe vagina envy or fear about women and women's sexual power. And so I think so much of it is this attempt to clamp down, regulate, and control women.
And let's talk about, you had a notice in there about violence, domestic violence, perhaps, violence against women.
I just want to remind our listeners that we're talking to Beverly McPhail, who wrote an op-ed piece in the Chronicle, and is also author of Confronting Sexism and Violence Against Women. Where's that book available?
Amazon.com is probably the easiest way for people to get it.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Violence against women is a special interest of mine, and there's a couple areas there that the Bush administration is going after violence against women programs. What's sort of interesting to me is that the conservatives, the Republicans, seem to think, I don't really understand the reasoning fully, but they seem to think that the violence against women movement is a conspiracy of feminists. And they think that really violence against women doesn't happen that often. And they think it's a way we feminists try to keep ourselves employed. And so they really are anti-violence against women program. And that amazes me, because you would think, you know, when women get raped and beaten, it's nonpartisan. Bipartisan issue. I mean, it affects all women, regardless of class and race and sexual orientation. So you think everybody could get behind that, but they don't. They think that it's inflated, that it's some kind of feminist conspiracy, and they do everything they can to once again dismantle programs. Currently, Congress passed a Department of Justice reauthorization bill, which President Bush did sign, and as part of this, it made the Violence Against Women Office a distinct branch within the Department of Justice. Before, it had been a smaller program kind of subsumed under the Office of Justice Programs, but it made it a bigger entity with reporting powers directly to the Attorney General. Well, Ashcroft is trying to push it back down and make it just a small program to sort of delegitimize it, to give it less power and authority. Again, Ashcroft, there's an advisory panel that kind of oversees the Violence Against Women Act, which was an act that gave more money and training and all sorts of programs for violence against women. And he's appointing, and I love how they do this, because I call them stealth candidates. They appoint women. So you think, oh, this is great. You know, women are concerned about women, and yeah. they're on this panel. But they're conservative Republican women who are against the Violence Against Women Act, and they're the ones who are overseeing it. I mean, it really is like the wolf guarding the hen house.
Well, that's like with the AIDS Commission, where they tried to appoint that gentleman who called, you know, gay people abominations and AIDS a death style, and wanted and advocated, I think, what, locking people with AIDS up in camps and
right.
stuff.
Right, or yeah. Christy Todd Whitman, who was head of the environmentalist concerns of this country, and they're all being swept away.
Yeah,
I don't know how she can even, you know, face the public with a straight face.
It does make you wonder. I mean, I wonder how these women can kind of sleep at night. And it is kind of a paradox, because these are like prominent, intelligent, articulate women who keep other women one down. And I don't understand why that is. I mean, it's like people like Phyllis Schlafly.
Because the right wing signs her paycheck?
Maybe so.
Well, and these are all things that are happening in the executive office, but these all get funded through the legislative branch.
Right.
And even though it's being controlled by, both branches are being controlled by Republicans, you would think that some of the opposition, the minority party, would be either waving flags instead of hiding under the table sometimes on these issues.
Well, I think that's a good point, and I really can't speak to why they don't do more. I mean, Senator Biden is a real supporter and the sponsor of the Violence Against Women Act, and he speaks up. But my concern is there's so much focus on, you know, the big issues of the day, you know.
Yeah.
The
Iraq,
one issue of the
yes,
day, right.
Yes,
Iraq, yeah.
And everything else is just going down the tubes and is unnoticed and really
unreported in a lot of cases.
Exactly, exactly. And I do think when this war, I guess, that's maybe is going to be, is over. I think one day the American people are going to wake up and just be shocked at what has gone by, what they have missed, the rights that have been eroded. I mean, we talk about the civil liberties, and there's been some attention to the erosion of civil liberties, but I don't think near enough attention to the erosion of women's civil liberties. And I think women are going to be really surprised one day when, I mean, the ultimate concern is that there's going to be an overturning of Roe v. Wade, because he's going to put a conservative person on the Supreme Court. And I don't know, maybe that will wake people up. I mean, when I guess that's the only good thing. When you take rights for granted, we all do get a little complacent.
Mm-hmm.
When that goes away, I think hopefully, this is my hope, there'll be an upsurging, a backlash where people, women especially, and women and our allies, you know, wake up and advocate, start getting active again, come out of our complacency, because these rights that we thought, yeah, been there, done that, they're threatened again today in 2003, and that's shocking.
Well, we are seeing people show up at rallies and marches and stuff like that, more than we've probably seen in a long time. But beyond just showing up for marches, I don't know if people are actually getting involved and trying.
Or voting, or registering voting. To vote, making sure other people are registered to vote, making sure people who are registered actually vote. I mean, you know, we live in a city. I mean, you know, Houston is
less than half
yeah,
the people vote.
Exactly.
That
I
are
mean,
eligible.
And we are a pretty, you know, we're a very populous city, and we still can't get people out to vote. We're a very politically active city, and we still can't get people out to vote.
Yeah, I do think that's a problem, you know, across the board, and I'm not sure exactly what to do about it. Because as much as I think a lot of women have feminist viewpoints, it's kind of a joke within the feminist community. People, a lot of women will say, well, I'm not a feminist, but, and then they espouse this very feminist viewpoint. So, you know, we call feminism the other F word, that feminists are sort of reluctant to identify as such. And once again, it's about stereotypes, you know, that feminists are these bra-burning, man-hating, you know, women, and not don't see
but
the...
again, that's a myth perpetuated by the right, just like the myth that all media is liberal. I love that one. That one just, I could just laugh for days. I mean, it's like, it's that old joke, you know, if you repeat something often enough, people start to believe it.
Right. Framing the issues.
Right.
And I think that's part of our problem is that the other side is framing these issues.
Well, and that's really how I started writing for the Chronicle. They published maybe my editorials two or three times a year, but I just got so tired of picking up the paper and never seeing my viewpoint represented. And so finally I said, well, I guess I will try to write. And I think they do try to give the other side a chance now and then.
I was so afraid when the Post went out of business that
yes.
the Chronicle was just going to, you know, just take over. But I have to give them some credit in the fact that they have published the other the other side occasionally they give that. And some of the reporters are pretty good, and they try to be fair on the issues. But overwhelmingly, the Chronicle is more conservative. And just like how they try to frame Fox News as being centrist, when we all know it's right wing, and everybody else is trying to
move further to the right.
Actually, the term is to out-Fox Fox.
Right.
And the reality is that, you know, I even think NPR is a little bit more towards the right. You know, they're fairer than everybody else, but still. And we're the niche. Pacifica is definitely the niche. Beverly, thank you for joining us.
Well, I really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
Great. Besides authoring the book Confronting Sexism and Violence Against Women, have you done any other writing?
I mostly in journal articles. I'm an academic. I just got my PhD at UT in at Austin, and so I wrote mostly in academic journals. Y'all would probably be interested to hear this little piece. I do gender-based hate crimes, because it was interesting. Gender did get slipped into the James Byrd Jr. Hate Crime Act, but not too many people know about it. And for my dissertation research, I traveled the state and talked to prosecutors to find out what did they think of having gender in the hate crime law, and would they use it. And just in brief, because I know we're concluding here, is they didn't even know it was in there. In fact, they were kind of confused, and they said, well, gender? No, you mean sexual orientation. So I had to do a little song and dance, the difference between gender and sexual identity.
Well, thank you. Beverly McPhail, her book is Confronting Sexism and Violence Against Women, and it's available on Amazon.com. You're listening to Queer Voices.
Sneaker, not just to drive in. I want to wear an Adidas sweatsuit, not just to sleep in. I want to be a jock. I want to strength to lift heavy weights, stare at myself in the mirror and say I look great. I want to take 4 periods of gym, sweat like a dog. My shirt off in 50 degree weather, so that my friends could say that guy's body's all together.
Queer Voices.
Good evening. I'm Joan Devlin, and you're listening to Queer Voices. We have Sana Alton from the Montrose Clinic. You're wearing a very cool Montrose Clinic shirt, by the way.
Thank you.
And you're going to be talking to us this week about something kind of unique. Is LGBT Health Awareness Week coming up here, starting on March 16th?
March 16th through the 23rd. This is actually a unique idea that was birthed from the National Healthcare Coalition for LGBT or lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender health issues. And there's just such a lack of it out there in the United States that they decided, well, let's create an awareness week and see what people across the United States can do in response to addressing these healthcare issues. And so we decided to try a health fair. you know, people in our community, they don't come in for preventative maintenance, so to speak. And oftentimes when they seek health care, it's at the point when they're really sick. And so we started contacting people, and it's like this thing just took on an identity all its own. And all these people started donating services towards this health fair. And so we're going to have this health fair on March 18th at the Montrose Clinic. We're starting at 3 o'clock, and we're offering just a number of free health care screenings, and it's open to everyone. We certainly wouldn't want to exclude anyone because, you know, we're about serving the underserved and the needy people in our community.
And this is a pretty broad range of testing. I'm sitting here reading your brochure, and it says, you know, you're screening for everything from, you know, HIV and AIDS to cholesterol, anemia, diabetes. You're doing eye exams. You're doing women's health. I mean, so pretty much anything anyone needs, they can probably find at this health fair.
Well, we certainly wanted to include everyone as much as we could in our services. And as I said, a number of people stepped up. St. Joseph's Hospital has a community program that has a mobile unit, and they actually come out and they do the diabetes and cholesterol and blood pressure and PSA screenings. And it's all donated. And it's mostly targeted, you know, towards senior citizens. But when it's not in service and our day happened to fall on a free day for them, and that's why I said it just kind of fell together. And so we're able to offer especially these screenings because people are at risk for cholesterol and diabetes, especially with the prevalence of obesity in lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community. We tend to be a little bit overweight and less active. And you know, many people don't know if they're anemic or not. And so we had another provider decide to give us a screening for that. And then we utilize some of our services that we have. We've had an eye clinic for a number of years, and we do primary health care now for all. And so we're trying to expand our programs and let people in the community know that we really are here for them and more than just HIV services.
Yeah, I understand your building's pretty full these days.
Yes, originally built for about 35 people, and I think our staff has now grown to over 80.
Wow.
And we're now in two locations because we have branched out so much with our services. And so when we merged with Body Positive Wellness Center a few years ago, it created a need for space. And so we've just recently moved our Body Positive Wellness Center, the Frost Eye Clinic, and our research division over on Richmond. And it's actually in the original location of the Fitness Exchange. So we kind of keep it all in the family.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And we expanded our eye clinic. We now have, you know, two full service rooms, again, to be able to provide affordable services for all. And many people don't realize that. And another new service that we've added with our Body Positive wellness program, we have registered dietitians, we have fitness trainers, and we've been doing programs for a number of the people affected with HIV and the wasting syndrome. And we decided, again, there are many people that need those services. So we're expanding those services at a fee-for-service.
Is there a concern with the funding?
Always.
That's, I guess, yes.
it's always a struggle, and certainly I think the current political climate makes it more of a challenge, and you're seeing, you know, many people being laid off, and which creates an increased demand for our services. And again, we hope that we'll never have to turn anyone away. So we continue to seek funding to be able to provide our services or to offer low cost. Because as you know, many people in our community don't have health insurance.
Right, right. It's not available or it's unaffordable.
Exactly. And so we're hoping that people can learn that we're out there for them and come down and utilize all of our services. And the other thing is I wanted this to really try and be a community event. And so a number of the different community organizations, Montrose Counseling Center, the Lesbian Health Initiative, Assist HERS, PWA Coalition, and anyone else that has a program that would like to come and have a table and present their material, we certainly want everyone to know, look what we have in the Montrose community. And if you're in need of services, again, in the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community, we tend to see more mental health issues. And, you know, those have to be addressed. And we're going to have just a little screening, a mental health screening. And people kind of laugh at that because they're like, a mental health screening. But hopefully, again, it may lead somebody to seek care before they get to the point where they're just, you know, depressed and almost suicidal. So we hope that we can encourage people to come down, try out these services, learn a little bit more about their health, and be more proactive.
Now, when somebody walks into the health fair, do they have to show need? How does that all work?
We're just basically there for everyone. This is kind of a trial by error, and we'll see how it works. And hopefully, we'll be able to accommodate everyone that day. With our women's health services, we are offering free pap smear exams. And so if we get too many, we may have to schedule those to come in at a later date, but hopefully we'll be able to accommodate everyone. We certainly do not want to turn anyone away.
And where is this happening at?
It's, again, it's March 18th from 3 to 7 p.m. at the Montrose Clinic located at 215 Westheimer. And if you'd like additional information, you can call our main line at 713-830-3000.
And for anybody who can't get there by car, the number 82 bus will get you right there.
Yes. And also, we've just redone our website and hopefully have added a lot of useful, not only healthcare information and STD information, but a lot of links so people can kind of come to our website and really take off and go wherever they need to get their healthcare issues answered. And this is a work in progress. We want to continue to really reach out and to educate people about the special healthcare issues of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community. I'm trying to avoid the alphabet because, you know, we tend to abbreviate and just use initials.
And what is the website address?
It's www.montroseclinic.org.
Oh, that's easy. Okay. And again, when is the health fair?
It's March 18th, 3 to 7 p.m., located at 215 Westheimer. And we're also going to hopefully have some door prizes and some other fun things going on that day. So hopefully it'll be an enjoyable and an awareness educational activity for everyone.
Great. Zana, thank you very much for coming by. Zana Alton is the communications director for the Montrose Clinic here in downtown Montrose, basically, just around the corner here from KPFT. You're listening to Queer Voices.
To my dearest little sister, Sally Brown, it's Charlie here. A lot of things have happened since you skipped town. For one, I'm queer. For about a year. I know, of course, you might be less than psyched about the path I took. But I had to face the fact that I kinda liked how Linus looked before he booked. Cause Patty came out and left me shocked and confused. She shacked up with Marcy, who was clearly abused. And I picked up a needle that had just been used before. Now Lucy's playing hockey, her team just won the Stanley Cup. Schroeder dressed just like Beethoven did and ties her up. And she barks like a pup. And the hunt is on for Linus, but as you know, he's hard to catch. You see, he found that lots of interesting things could grow in the pumpkin patch. But the feds are no match. Cause he and the red-haired girl split the scene. The psilocybin sultan and the cannabis queen. And Franklin shot two back and now he ain't nowhere to be seen. Wah 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 wah. Break it down. Woodstock got eaten by the cat who lives next door. Snoopy got neutered, and now he ain't Joe Cool no more. And he's still kinda sore. And Pigpen OD'd was just a matter of time. He couldn't keep a job on account of the grime, and he couldn't face a future of small town crime no more. So write us all a letter and tell us how the city is. Frida said she saw you, so tell me, how's the porno biz? My little sis, the porno biz, my little sis.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry. Spoken guy, a kind of sweet, kind of shy, makes me wonder if I should even give him a try. But then he really can't shy, he can't shy you forever. And I know I'm gonna make him mine if it takes
not later.
Gotta get together, the sooner the better.
I just can't wait to be held in his arms.
If I were a queen and he asked me to leave my throne, I would do anything that he asked, anything to make him my own.
This is J.D. Doyle, and we're back. You just heard, obviously, He's So Fine by Tom Bogdan. Before that, Eric Swartz did Charlie Something.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Valensky, Joan Devlin, and Glenn Holt.
Hey! Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy.
Well, we have a real treat this evening. One of the almost founding bars, I don't know quite it was at the beginning, but definitely an early bar called Kindred Spirits. Marion Coleman is here, and Marion started the bar, right? Am I correct? Yes, I am.
Okay. The founder in 1980.
Yeah, because some of this stuff predates me here in Houston.
that's scary.
Jack, that's hard to believe.
It doesn't predate Ray Hill, but nothing predates Ray Hill.
That's true.
And if he either makes it up or... but Kindred Spirits was a bar, mostly women's bar, but not exclusively women's.
Exactly.
It was more of a community bar, and it was very much a bright, very open, very clean, very well run, and you know, we used to have pride meetings there.
That's
years,
right.
years
right.
ago. And unfortunately, it's still not, it's not with us today.
No.
Mary, why don't you tell us a little bit about starting the bar and what were some of the trials and tribulations and all the sweat that you had to put into it?
I don't think you have all evening for me to go. Well, we didn't really have a night, although there were several bars in Houston that women could go to, they weren't as safe as they could have been. And so I decided that it was time for us to open up a space that would be a safe place for all people to come, and especially women. And so with the help of Sarah Fitzgerald, I really didn't know anything about the bar business, and Sarah helped me to understand the bar business. And with a lot of people helping, we founded Kindred Spirits, and we tried to make it a safe, elegant place for women and all people to come, and it was very successful.
And it was also a meeting place for a number of organizations,
right,
and sort of a real community spirit.
Exactly. I think my favorite time at Kindred Spirits was when the Thursday before Thanksgiving, we used to have the friends and families of gays come to the bar, and we'd put tablecloths and plants and a bottle of champagne. And our customers would bring their mom and dad, uncles and family and friends, and they would dance together and celebrate. And then we'd get them upstage, and they'd introduce their mother or father. And then one father one time said, "I wish my daughter had told me about this place a long time ago." So it was kind of neat to see fathers dancing with their sons and mothers dancing with their daughters and vice versa. That was a very unique experience for me.
Well, and this also, you know, as we're talking about what happened back then, we also don't realize all the discrimination that was,
yes,
there. It's a lot easier nowadays to go into a non-gay bar and be more open than you were before, or other businesses.
Right.
But, you know, the bars were sort of our churches in the early days.
That's very true.
The only place that we were able to even feel comfortable about it.
That's true. In the early days,
did you have any problem dealing with any of the city officials or dealing with the fact that it was a gay bar?
Not really. Of course, we had a wonderful mayor, Mayor Whitmire, and she was very protective of us. And the police were very good to us. And, of course, we hired HPD as our security, and they came to respect Kindred Spirits and how it was run and the clientele and the people that worked there. So we really didn't have any problem with that at all.
Right. And how long was the bar open?
9 years.
9 years. And through all that time, you had a number of organizations that were sort of like, they called it your home bar, I would guess.
Oh, yes. We had plays that were put on there.
Right. Joe Watts did some of the plays.
Oh, yeah. He was really wonderful.
Yes, Little Whorehouse.
Yeah, right. That's right. We had several plays that he put on, and that was very successful. We had major fundraisers there for various organizations. But one of the key things is our meetings, we held meetings every Monday, and we'd get the staff together and we'd educate them about what was going on in the community, such as the clinic and the Counseling Center, Gay Pride Week, and the events that were going on, and we tried to educate them. And of course, when we started suffering with people living with AIDS, that was very difficult to deal with, and so we educated our staff so that they could educate the people that came in, and we could let them know what was going on in the community. So it was sort of like an educational forum, and that was a real treat, too, that we could do that.
Romanowski and Phillips also, first time they
That's
played,
right.
was at Mary,
yeah.
at,
really?
Kindred Spirits.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I don't remember the date, But
Rita Mae Brown came to our bar, and of course she doesn't drink, and she came to our bar and found it to be one of the nicest, safest, cleanest places that she'd ever been. And then we've had Gloria Steinem, and we've had a lot of dignitaries come to our bar too. And we had policemen, fire people from the TV media that would come by and just sit with us through happy hour.
Right.
And we even had our very own Jerry Atwood come and perform with us. In fact, he didn't you start pretty close to
Jerry, do you want to share some memories?
Well, I played there occasionally with a lady named Alicia. We went by Cookies and Cream, and we were there about, I think, one night a week for a good while.
Uh-huh.
It was good fun. Some good spirit in that place, and a lot of good memories.
Well, let's talk about the reunion. I mean, now we have reunions.
Well, that's very true. It's very exciting. Kindred Spirits Reunion operates under the umbrella of Christmas Song Fest, which Jerry founded. And his board agreed to allow us to use his umbrella status so that we could raise money, but basically get the women and men together again to have a really good time. And Jerry and Kim perform for a period of time. We have an excellent DJ in Terry Flores of Bacardi, and she's a great DJ, and the spirit is wonderful when she starts playing. And of course, when Jerry gets up on the stage, that's the cream of the crop. And no, Jerry.